From the Land Grant University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 19th day of May, 2026. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Naomi Bloom. She's at TotalFarmMarketing.com out of West Bend, Wisconsin. Then we'll turn our attention to the agricultural energies. Dave Chatterton will join us. He'll talk about miles driven for the summertime, what that means for ethanol and blends, and we'll also discuss how long it might take for the price of crude oil to drop if and when the Strait of Hormuz were to open. And we'll also talk today about the weather forecast, too. We'll do that with Don Day at Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming, on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, July corn for the day settled at $4.75 and a quarter, a penny and three quarters lower. September, $4.81 and a half, down three quarters. And December at $4.97 and three quarters, a quarter of a cent lower. July beans down three and a half at $12.09 and a half. November, $12.03, up 2 cents for the day. Bean meal down $2.20. Bean oil, 19 cents lower. And soft red winter wheat in the July, two and three quarters higher at $6.67 and a quarter. The hard red at $7.03 and three quarters, finished unchanged. Naomi Bloom from TotalFarmMarketing.com now joins us to take a look at the marketplace on this Tuesday. Hi, thanks for being with us, Naomi. Talk me through yesterday and then the overnight and day trade today, which was not nearly as exciting.
Well, exactly right. So yesterday, grain markets on fire with a recovery bounce higher on news that the U.S. and China, of course, we were going to be doing some more trading, but there was talk of an additional like $17 billion worth of ag goods from the United States in addition to the soybeans. So that really perked the market up. But then today when we start off, we're not getting any specific news of what is going to be entailed with those additional purchases or when or the quantity. So we're seeing a little bit of a pullback today in some of the grain markets. Also, with the December contract for corn, still not able to get through that $5 area. It tried yesterday, couldn't quite do it. Tried again today, couldn't do it. November beans, though, today are looking like they're going to be able to close above that $12 mark. But the question will be if they have any follow-through tomorrow. Again, front and center, everyone's attention is to see if any in the morning flash sales are announced for export sales from China. Will they be buying from us sooner than later, or are they going to wait and do their buying maybe at the end of August or early September, which is a lot of times when we see them come into our marketplace near our harvest low?
We'll have to wait and see. In that space of time, how do you tell producers to manage that new crop, soybean or corn sale that they will eventually have to make?
Yeah, so my bias here for now is, unless proven otherwise, and proven otherwise would mean an intense flare-up in the Middle East or a sudden shift in weather, you have to kind of assume that things are going to go well for producing this crop. We still have planting pace that's ahead of expectations. There's already people talking on the newswire today about, big corn yields, so the potential for that. So with that in mind, do be mindful of protecting the value that's in front of you, either with cash sales or looking at some different put option strategies. And then, of course, if you're, down the road, if something does happen with the Middle East, or if we go into a flash drought situation later this summer, we can look at reownership with call strategies. But I think right now the market is going to go back into its normal flex of prove me wrong. And then so when we're in that mentality space, then a lot of times we see grain prices do their seasonal thing where they'd start to drift lower in May to June. And then after Father's Day weekend in June, a lot of times there's that big sell-off all the way into mid to late August.
Okay, I do want to ask you about the world ag supply and demand estimates and those tables. USDA does a pretty good job of defining what current policy is. For instance, the 25 million metric tons for soybeans, new crop, would have already been built into the May tables that were just released. And corn purchases by China have been built in already. I'm wondering how you think they're doing on old crop buys. I think they're behind at this point still.
So regarding the Chinese purchases of ag products from the United States, I feel like what they have done was kind of meet that initial mark of what they were talking about back in the fall and then early November. Then once the new year approached, that's when President Trump said, oh, they're going to potentially be buying this additional 12 million metric tons. And that's what we aren't seeing yet. So the old crop ending stocks numbers in regards to the old crop exports, that could be something that fluctuates. Right now, the USDA has old crop corn exports for corn pegged at 3.3. New crop, they're saying it's going to be lower, 3.1. But to your point on soybeans, the USDA increased export for soybean demand for new crop. So they have now exports for soybeans now going to be at 1.63 billion bushels, up from 1.53 on the data sheet. So they are trying to say that. They do think that Chinese demand will be there for the new crop, but the question will be, are there going to be any changes on the June or July WASDE for old crop export demand?
Oh, I had nearly forgotten about the 12 million metric tons that were kind of on the books, but not anywhere officially, and was thinking just that the 8 million metric tons and Jameson Greer had talked about the 25 million metric tons being in each of the president's additional years in office. So that put them as calendar years, and I just had changed my mind about what was bought when. Interesting stuff. What else are you watching at this point in the marketplace?
Well, so on the livestock side, just don't forget we've got a cattle on feed report on Friday, and the talk is that it might be a little bit negative. So we'll want to keep an eye on that. And then I also read today that next week, speaking of Greer, he's going to be in Mexico meeting with the president of Mexico. And it was going to be more of like a talk about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. But we'll see if there's any conversation in there regarding U.S. ag exports to Mexico. Or is there going to be talk about cattle border opening from Mexico into the United States? So that's going to be on the docket for next week. So do keep an eye on that. And again, and this cattle on feed report on Friday, which might finally get this market to shift out of this little short-term sideways trading pattern that it's been in for both the live cattle and the feeder cattle.
And just one other note, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer is the person we've been talking about. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Naomi Bloom. She is with TotalFarmMarketing.com. The right to repair settlement has gotten preliminary approval. The U.S. District Court for the District of Northern Illinois yesterday granted preliminary approval to Deere's proposed $99 million settlement to resolve numerous farmer-initiated lawsuits filed in 2022. Reuters reported in early April that Deere had agreed to pay the $99 million in settlement funds for farms and farmers that are part of class action suit over costs and access to repairs. The case is part of broader scrutiny in the United States over the so-called right to repair practices. The regulators and plaintiffs arguing that some manufacturers limit competition by controlling access to repair tools and software. The settlement fund covers eligible plaintiffs who paid Deere's authorized dealers for repairs to large agricultural equipment from January 2018, according to a document filed yesterday in the federal court in Chicago. Deere is now also facing a right to repair suit in construction equipment. Well, let's stay in Illinois for the moment. The U.S. Department of Agriculture wants to move two of the nation's most important seed banks out of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. But as Abigail Botar, ag reporter here at Illinois Public Media, reports, some experts worry the change could harm corn and soybean research.
The USDA is proposing moving the country's only public soybean seed bank to Columbia, Missouri, and the Maize Genetics Cooperation Stock Center to Ames, Iowa. The maize collection includes irreplaceable corn stocks and has been housed on the University of Illinois campus for more than 70 years. University of Illinois professor of crop sciences Martin Booth Boone says he's worried the proposed location in Iowa doesn't have the physical infrastructure or personnel to properly care for the collection.
The material in the stock center, this is very special, and you need to have expertise. You need to know how to handle these.
In a statement, the USDA said the move would bring the collections closer to the farmers and ranchers they serve. I'm Abigail Botar, IPM News.
Now there's more from the state of Illinois today. When Central Illinois farmer Steve Hess found out his community had won a fight against Navigator CO2 Ventures, that's a Dallas, Texas-based company building a pipeline to transport carbon dioxide across the region for storage underground, he threw a party. Navigator was calling for eminent domain, the right of the company to purchase private land for public good, to route the Heartland Greenway pipeline through farmland across the region. Now, the Illinois legislature is getting into the act, considering a bill that would ban companies from using eminent domain to seize land for CO2 pipelines. The bill was brought to the General Assembly by Hess, Sangamon County resident Kathleen Campbell, and other members of the Coalition to Stop CO2 Pipelines. That's the group that formed in 2022 to fight Navigator. Now let's move out of Illinois and to Washington, D.C., where the former chairman of the U.S. House Agriculture Committee says there are still headwinds facing nationwide year-round E15 legislation. Colin Peterson tells Brownfield he's expecting legislation to have an uphill battle in the U.S. Senate. Senator Boozman, he says, in Arkansas and others in Oklahoma are very concerned about this and how you bridge that divide with the SREs, the small refinery exemptions, and so forth. Peterson says infrastructure is also a hurdle. We have infrastructure in Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa to dispense E15. Most of the country does not have that, he goes on. And so even if year-round E15 legislation were to pass, he thinks there's not a lot of places that would use it. And so it's not going to be the demand that some people think it is. Peterson admits there is money available to build out E15 infrastructure, but not everyone will take advantage. And finally, electric car supporters are concerned a new fee that would force EV owners to pay as much as $150 annually nationwide to help pay for roads will dampen demand for plug-in products at a time when gas prices have prompted some car shoppers to consider going electric. The new proposed EV fee will start at $135 annually beginning in October 2026 if a new bipartisan draft of a 5-year surface transportation funding bill that Congress is considering becomes law. Under the proposed legislation, which has been dubbed the Build America 250 Act, the fee can be increased by $5 each year until it hits its maximum of $150 annually. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Each Tuesday, we take a look at the agricultural energies. Dave Chatterton is here now from Strategic Farm Marketing. He's right here in Champaign, Illinois. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being with us. Let's start with what you think the broad scope of the agricultural energies look like today.
Yeah, Todd. I mean, still a bit of a struggle here in terms of just on-farm diesel fuel prices and kind of where we're at. If you look at the broader market in terms of, you know, futures market and kind of where we're at globally, it's still, you know, a market that's unfortunately captive to headlines, and those headlines specifically about Iran or about the Strait of Hormuz. And we're getting a lot of back and forth in those headlines between, you know, we've got a ceasefire here that's somewhat fragile, but is holding for the most part while we're waiting for hopefully a negotiated end to the conflict and a reopening of the strait. But for now, it's hard for energy prices to relax as the problem could go from, you know, where it's at today to getting even worse if the U.S., you know, calls off negotiations and calls the attacks back on and it even increases them, or it could get much better, certainly, if we do get an accord that opens the strait. So we're still, you know, relatively trapped here at some high values, Todd. As far as we can tell, I mean, negotiations, you know, President Trump overnight and this morning called off his latest attacks, if you will, so the negotiations were underway and were progressing. We've kind of heard that line a few times in the process here, which I guess is not all that unusual. But as far as we can tell, really neither side budging from their negotiating positions. And what the U.S. wants, what Iran is asking for, you know, seem to be still pretty far apart. So I guess we're waiting to see how things get resolved. And in the meantime, we're watching global inventories continue to decline. The IEA even, you know, with that, was out with a piece yesterday talking about March and April global oil inventories falling at the fastest level on record, over 246 million barrels just in those two months or those 60 days. So, you know, we're coming to a point here where we have to, an inflection point where we have to kind of solve this situation one way or the other, either by higher prices and rationing demand or by, you know, opening the strait and getting the supply situation back in line.
If we do open the strait, and I made note that the analyst at Gas Buddy had made comments that for every day of the war, he thought it would take a full week to recover supply and move back down. So we're in 70 or something like that days. That would be, you know, more than a year to get back down to a price without the Strait of Hormuz being closed. How long do you think it might take?
Yeah, Todd, it's a really interesting question, and one we don't have much of a template or historical, you know, relevance for. So I wouldn't say that he's far off in doing that, but I would say that, you know, you never want to underestimate the ability of market participants to pull a dollar off the table. So when margins are strong and when there's money to be made, people get very creative and do things that maybe think them that, you know, traditional economists don't think they should be able to do. So I don't know if it's quite that long, but certainly it's going to take a while. We're going to see if we, you know, if we fast forward to a situation that we get a potential peace accord and the strait reopens and traffic resumes, we're certainly going to get a reaction in the futures market. I think the cash market is going to be much slower to respond. And, you know, I think one thing that we didn't talk about, or maybe we should point out, is that we're much more fortunate here in the U.S., even though we're dealing with high prices and, let's say, $5, you know, farm diesel. We're much more fortunate than other parts of the world that are more heavily dependent on imports and of oil. And so, you know, we're feeling the pinch a little bit less than, let's say, that farmer in South America or that consumer in Europe or whatever it might be. But, you know, we should recover, I think, quicker than the world, but it's still going to take a while for that tail, if you will, to kind of get to the to meet a conclusion here.
Farmers still will have to deal with this, certainly going through the fall, maybe into the spring and possibly next fall, depending on how things go. But let's deal with the short term. What are you suggesting to producers today as it relates to their fuel needs, whether that be natural gas for drying or diesel for harvest in the fall?
Yeah, Todd, kind of going a little bit hand to mouth here. We want to keep a little bit of working inventory in front of us here. There's not a supply crunch in the U.S. at present, but we are seeing diesel fuel LPGs continue to get exported here, and the arbitrage, you know, window, particularly for diesel fuel, is now open to Europe, to Mexico, to Brazil. As these world prices rally, you know, at a little bit stronger rate than what we've seen here. So we need to keep an eye on inventories going forward, and certainly not, I don't think, time to push the panic button at these types of values, but we'll be opportunistic for the fall, but going to drag our feet here just a little bit.
So the idea is we have to watch the Strait of Hormuz, the price of crude oil, Brent in particular, WTI as well, to see if they react and how quickly, if the price gets high enough, that actually other parts of the world start to purchase from the United States, I guess.
Yeah, correct, Todd. I mean, we've got a big inverse in our futures market for, let's say, for diesel fuel. So call it, you know, 410, 412 on the lead month futures. If you go out to October, we're at 355. But we can't find those kind of inverted values in the cash market here from a contracting standpoint. So if we start to see the front of the market fall, we want to see that back of the market soften as well with it. And like I said, you want to be pretty opportunistic, you know, if we do start to fall here.
Turn your attention to ethanol. Any reason to be worried about the summer driving season as it relates to the number of miles Americans might put on their vehicles?
Well, I think we haven't seen a lot of anecdotal evidence in the data yet that the driving is slowing down in the U.S. Now, certainly that can be the case the deeper into the crisis that we go and the more consumer debt, let's say, that's piling up on credit cards, et cetera. But for right now, ethanol margins remain fairly frothy. We're maybe a dime below the peak that we had here several weeks ago, but values continue to look very good. The discount of ethanol to gasoline is pushing $2 a gallon and in some cases here, and the plants are benefiting from not only high good blending margins, but also strong RIN values, and profitability is there. They're going to run those plants absolutely as hard as they can here in the near term. The export side of the fence is starting to heat up just a little bit. So I think the demand is there, and so far so good. We'll keep an eye on this driving situation through the spring. There's been talk about E15 and in the farm bill, and it looks like this is going to be dead in the Senate, but it did get past the House, so we'll keep an eye on the political front here as well.
Thank you much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Dave Chatterton. He is with Strategic Farm Marketing, online at sfarmmarketing.com. Don Day is with Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and now joins us to take a look at the forecast for the Corn Belt. Actually, Don, I'd like to start out in Cheyenne where you are. We talked about 10 inches of snow, I think, that you had gotten fairly recently. Kind of a late snow shower, snowstorm for you. You've gotten more, is that right?
Yeah. Over the last 48 hours, Interstate 80 was closed down for more than 24 hours from some locations picking up 12 to 30 inches of snowfall along that interstate stretch as it goes around the mountains of southern Wyoming into Utah. And the water in the west badly need more, but a couple of May snowstorms certainly going to help the water outlook a little bit out west. And some of the winter wheat country, portions of eastern Colorado, portions of Nebraska and western Kansas and the panhandles, now, they didn't get snowed on, but they did see some rain.
Yeah. How helpful do you think that rain will be to a crop that is getting closer to maturity?
Well, that's a good question. It may be a little too late, but I don't think it's going to hurt, especially with soil moisture profiles. Maybe longer term, getting that soil moisture profile back. The outlook does look better for some of that winter wheat country. But again, as you mentioned, we're at the tail end. So hopefully some folks will benefit. But as we know, that wheat outlook has been taking a beating with the drought out west.
Turn your attention to parts of Kansas and Nebraska, kind of the Corn Belt areas. Have they improved?
Well, it depends on where you are. Central and eastern Nebraska, some areas got a little bit too much of a good thing. A lot of severe weather, tornadoes, hail, but also some very beneficial rains. Unfortunately, the beneficial rains kind of missed the Sandhills region and into the Panhandle. But central and eastern Nebraska and a good part of Iowa all has picked up over the last 7 days some really good rainfall. But it has come at a cost, and that was with severe weather.
What are your expectations for the broader Corn Belt for the coming week?
Short term, between now and the end of the week, it's going to be actually fairly quiet. We're going to see the severe weather shift into the south central and east central parts of the United States. We'll still have some rain in southern Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, but we're going to see drier conditions out in the northern and northwest areas of the Corn Belt until we get into next week. We'll see shower and thunderstorm activity return. So there's going to be kind of some gaps of drier conditions for 2 or 3 days, but also a fairly active pattern, I think, across the south and the central parts of the United States next week with warmer conditions, but also frequent thunderstorm opportunities.
Yeah, thank you much, Don.
Thanks, Todd.
That's Don Day. He is with Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joined us on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason.